Welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We're still fundraising at WBAI, meaning I was preempted again, so this is a KPFA exclusive. This morning's show is mostly devoted to an interview I recorded a couple of days ago with the Canadian political economist Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin on some of the long-term issues surrounding the current financial crisis, how it fits into the history of neoliberalism, what it means for U.S. global power, and how we might think about getting out of this mess, not just the short-term mess, but the deep structural one. And about that crisis. What a week it's been for the politics of finance. At the beginning of the week, the House of Representatives rejected the modified Paulson bailout proposal. Yesterday, after being well larded with pork, the bill passed and will become law. The initial rejection came mostly from the Republican right, but some of the more leftish Democrats helped out. Republican complaints were delusional. One of the leaders of the right flank of the anti-bailout camp, Jen Hensarling of Texas, said that the rescue plan would lead the U.S. down the road to socialism. If only. As Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin will tell us shortly, neoliberalism has always depended on the state for its introduction and maintenance. You could say the same for capitalism itself. Markets aren't natural. They're imposed and sustained by political power. But if the right opposition was delusional, the left opposition flirted with the juvenile and sometimes even embraced it passionately. We heard many times over the last week or two, as Code Pink and UFPJ agitated for a no vote, that we shouldn't be handing money over to Wall Street. Instead, we should be spending it on schools and green jobs. Yes, I would love very much to spend lots of money on schools and green jobs, but presenting this as an either-or thing raises some problems. One problem is that those are long-term investments. They won't do anything to ease the immediate financial crisis. And another problem is that there aren't the votes in Congress or the support in the broader population for that kind of spending program. I wish that weren't the case, but it is. Don't the people calling for such things realize that? A number of progressive no proponents deny that there's any real financial crisis at all. They argue that it's a hoax, a shakedown, to transfer a few hundred billion from taxpayers to bankers. It would be helpful if those arguing for this position knew anything about finance or economics, but the closest thing to evidence I've seen supporting this case is a citation of Naomi Klein's shock doctrine. If you think it's a hoax, it does relieve you of the responsibility for suggesting what to do about the problem, since it's no longer a problem. How convenient. There's a lot I admire about the work of Naomi Klein, but this book is badly flawed. It's a one-size-fits-all version of history that's really not up to the task. It treats centuries-old features of capitalism as innovations. It totally ignores the fact that neoliberal regimes, many of them run by center-left parties, have repeatedly won elections in the U.S., Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and India. For more detailed critique, see my review on my website, leftbusinessobserver.com. It's one thing to misread history. It's another to use that misreading to misread the present. The crisis is real. The credit markets are imploding. Even some people who I thought should know better, like the normally sensible Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, are saying silly things. Dean denies there's any credit crisis because interest rates are low. But the credit crisis isn't about the price of credit, interest rates, but its availability, whether or not you can get a loan. And in a lot of areas, you can't. Banks have virtually ceased lending to each other. Dean cited allegedly low interest rates in interbank loans, but since such lending has virtually ceased, the interest rates are purely notional. Ditto mortgage loans. Dean cited low interest rates on mortgages, but they too are very difficult to get unless you've got a very high credit score and a big down payment. The commercial paper market, a major source of short-term funds for large banks and corporations, is contracting dramatically. And most signs are that these problems are getting worse, not better. If this continues, that it's likely to, it's only a matter of time before banks cut back further than they already have on the vital day-to-day loans to businesses, the loans that enable retailers to buy inventory and manufacturers to buy raw materials. Without those, the economy will grind to a halt. Dean sent out something on Friday after the House passed the bailout bill, blaming George Bush, Henry Paulson, and Ben Bernanke for creating a panic to get their bailout bill passed. There's no doubt they tried to take advantage of the panic to force through a scheme that would have given Paulson unchallenged power to do whatever he wanted to with $700 billion. That was an abomination. Congress did improve things by adding oversight, caps on executive pay, and some protections for homeowners facing foreclosure. None of that is good enough or strong enough, but it was an improvement. But to say that Bush, Paulson, and Bernanke created the panic is wrong. It is very real. It's not like the WMDs in Iraq. The symptoms of the panic are visible to anyone who looks, in the behavior of interest rates, stock market, and credit volumes. Of course, Bush and Paulson are pretty disreputable creatures, and I've got no interest in defending them. But I will put in a half a kind word for Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke. Bernanke made his reputation as an academic economist in large part for his work on how the collapse of the banking system brought about the Great Depression of the 1930s. It's not often that we have someone in high office with a great deal of relevant expertise, but now we do. The Fed is, of course, run by people with a deep interest in maintaining the class hierarchy of American society, but they also are interested in preventing total collapse. And Bernanke has a good sense of how collapse happens. I've seen some so-called leftists call for the whole system to come crashing down. That's not politics, that's nihilism. Surely there's a temptation to echo what Edmund Wilson said after the 1929 crack-up. One couldn't help being exhilarated at the sudden, unexpected collapse of that stupid, gigantic fraud. But the unemployment rate hit 25% in 1933. Do we really want that? I don't want to leave the impression that I think even the modified Paulson plan is a good one. It's probably better than nothing, but it's got a lot of problems. So let me say a few words about what might make a better one, first in the realistic sense, fully aware of the constraints of American politics, and then in a more fanciful sense, of what we might could do in a better world. A very useful guide to what could be done comes from a recent paper by two IMF economists, Luc Leban and Fabian Valencia. Their work isn't IMF ideology, but a historical database of banking crises around the world since 1970, all 124 of them. They take the measure of what was done to resolve them and how much they cost, and what works and what didn't. One crucial lesson stands out: speed matters. This is obvious to anyone who followed Japan's dithering in the 1990s. Standing aside and hoping the problem goes away is not a good idea. Paulson's original do-it-now schedule was way too accelerated, but waiting for months could be very damaging. Some sort of systemic restructuring is a key component of almost every banking crisis, meaning forced closures, mergers, and even nationalizations. The creation of asset management companies to handle distressed assets is a frequent feature of restructurings and part of Paulson's plan, but they do not appear to be terribly successful. More successful are recapitalizations using public money, which can often be recouped through privatization after the crisis passes. But these recapitalizations are not cheap. The cost for the U.S. would be several hundred billion dollars, but they do allow banks to come back to health and start lending again after a couple of years. Those who don't want to spend that kind of taxpayer money should consider this. Levon and Valencia find that there appears to be a negative correlation between output losses and fiscal costs. In other words, what you save in expenditures, you lose in a deeper recession. Oh, and about half the countries that have experienced crises have had some form of deposit insurance. So merely expanding the FDIC's coverage is not likely to do the trick, and in any case, it's going to be hard to escape the huge expense of a systemic recapitalization, though using the FDIC might simplify the politics of the rescue. And speaking of the politics of the rescue, all the claims we've heard about a new populist resistance to the big boys in Wall Street is at best a partial truth. Most polls show the public realizes that some sort of bailout package is necessary and fear that doing nothing would only make things worse. Opinions are murky and contradictory, which isn't a surprise given the size and complexity of the problem. But those who claim to speak for the people should check out what the people actually think. Once again, populism has shown itself to be less about popularity than it is about anger and righteous indignation. With the bailout now awaiting the president's signature, it's too late to modify it for now. But it could be revised with a new Congress and a new administration in power next year. So what might a better bailout scheme look like in light of the Levon-Valencia historical record? Purchasing bad assets and turning them over to an asset management corporation at the heart of the Paulson plan is not a promising strategy. It would be much better to inject funds into the banks. As Levon and Valencia say, such capital injections should be selective, meaning supporting those institutions with hope of revival while letting the terminal go down. And the authors also say that relief for distressed debtors supported with public funds has also shown success in banking crises and should be part of any rescue scheme in the U.S. as well. This is a nice instance in which justice and economic rationality coincide. Write off some of the bad debts and get on with it. Crises like this are manageable. They're expensive and painful to resolve, but even more expensive and painful when left to fester. Waxing more utopian, finance must be re-regulated. You can take that further and say that banking is rather like an old-style utility, something so essential to all of us that it should be regulated like electricity used to be before the preposterous experiment in utility deregulation. And if the government is bailing out and nationalizing banks and other financial intermediaries, why not keep some of them in the public sector? Why not use them to fund real economic development in neighborhoods starved for capital? Why not extend low-cost financial services to poor people who are now fleeced by check-cashing services and payday lenders? Oh, right, this is American capitalism, where we only socialize losses and never gains. One thing I would like to see is a demotion of the American fetish of homeownership. It's long struck me as odd that the official culture celebrates when housing gets more expensive. It's supposed to be a sign of a healthy economy, even though it makes it harder to afford one of life's essentials. American society has, for many decades, treated owning a house as one's prime material goal in life. Sometimes buying a house makes economic sense. In some circumstances, it can be cheaper than renting. That's a rational calculation. But that's not always the case. There's a long history of Americans really stretching to buy a house when they could have done better by renting. The Clinton administration, in accordance with the homeownership fetish, made a policy out of encouraging low or no money down purchases. That, combined with the cultural bias and the devious and innovative practices of the financial industry, helped contribute a lot to the whole subprime bubble. Why poor people should stretch to buy when they could more comfortably rent is beyond me. If it's about wealth accumulation, then be better off putting the money in the bank or spending the money on college tuition. If some good comes out of this housing bust, it might be a rethink of this aspect of the American dream. From an economic point of view, the U.S. is way overinvested in residential real estate. We'd be much better off buying less housing and using the resources instead to build a productive infrastructure. In fact, an excellent way to get us out of this slump over the longer term would be to have the government sponsor serious amounts of research into alternative energy and other environmentally friendly technologies. It could create good jobs and new industries and save life on Earth while we're at it. Finally, a few words about yesterday morning's employment report. The job market is clearly deteriorating. Employers shed 159,000 workers last month. Few sectors sported plus signs, and many saw major losses. Construction and manufacturing led the way down, and within those sectors, losses were widespread, meaning it's not just about cars and houses. Private services also took a big hit. Retail, trucking, and finance were all down pretty hard. Temp firms, which tend to lead broader employment trends, also contracted. Even that old reliable health care had only modest gains. Average earnings are lagging inflation by about 2%, and the average work week fell to a level that ties its all-time low. And although the unemployment rate held steady at 6.1%, it got some support from the fact that lots of people dropped out of the labor force and so weren't counted as officially jobless. The number of those working part-time because they couldn't find full-time work rose by 300,000 and is now up by 1.6 million over the last year. Still, these job losses are only half as large as they are in normal, meaning average recession months. But I suspect things are going to get worse in the coming months as the effects of the credit crisis spread. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to hear from Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin. Some of King's Lead Hat from Brian Eno's 1977 album Before and After Science. A triple play this morning from Eno. Pretty groovy sounds for that primitive 1970s electronics there. My guests this morning are Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin. Both teach political economy at York University in Toronto and are frequent collaborators. Sam spent many years as an economic advisor to the Canadian Auto Workers Union. An essay of theirs that covers a whole lot of what we're about to talk about is up on the ZNet website. Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin. Welcome to both of you. To some, this is looking like the end of, well, many things. The end of neoliberalism, the end of freewheeling finance, the end of America, maybe even the end of the world. So let's talk about just what all this is the end of. Let's start with a little on the modest scale. Is this the end of neoliberalism?
It could be. It's possible that some other form of organizing capitalism than we've known for the last 30-odd years could be the result of this particular crisis, but one should be careful before jumping to that conclusion. One needs to remember that although this is the most severe crisis, we've seen a succession of financial crises during the course of this neoliberal era, going all the way back to the debt crisis of the early 80s and the savings and loan crisis and the stock market crash at the end of the 80s, and the list is very long, leading right up to, of course, the bursting of the dot-com bubble and the Enronitis disaster at the beginning of this century. And, you know, similar things were said then, and regulations were introduced at each point, you know, in the wake of the debt crisis and the savings and loan and the stock market crash in which Japan was heavily involved. The Basel regulations were introduced at the end of the 80s. In the wake of Enronitis, you got the Sarbanes-Oxley regulation of corporations and their boards of directors and their accounting mechanisms. And people said then that was the end of neoliberalism, and it's by no means impossible that what we're going to see is a ramped up amount of regulation, but neoliberalism's never existed without it, without state intervention. It's always been an incredible myth.
Yeah, let's talk about that a bit, because people do say that the state is going to have to come back in, and it's going to be an enormous departure from what we've experienced over the last 20 or 30 years. How is this not such an enormous departure to have the state coming back in?
Well, insofar as the state has been in all along, this is, I think, an illusion. The state, neoliberalism couldn't have happened without the codification of the new set of rules within which market operators were indeed opened up to competition and flexibility, et cetera, especially in the financial sector. But all that needed a very active state to happen. The old regulations, when people speak of re-regulation going back to the New Deal, that wasn't a matter of Friedman having convinced people that they weren't good. It was a matter of finance having become too big for the incubator of the New Deal Bretton Woods order that was put in place after 1945 to get finance going again within the context of it having run up against the great crisis of the 1929 crash and the Great Depression. And by the 1960s, let alone the 1970s, it was outgrowing those regulations. Those regulations couldn't hold it. If you'd wanted to keep it within bounds, you would have had to have vastly increased controls in the form of capital controls, flows between countries, and controls over investment within countries. And that wasn't done. There were people who suggested it, but the balance of forces wasn't there. So what was done instead was a new form of regulation, to be sure, but one that opened up competition and flexibility, et cetera. Now, that has produced its own contradictions. It was always extremely volatile. The state was required all along to be jumping in, throwing liquidity into the system, and setting new rules, always relying on very heavily on self-regulation, to be sure, but people forget that the New Deal was also very largely a form of corporate self-regulation. So, I'm not saying that there won't be a lot more regulation. I think there will. I think a lot of the old competition and instruments are no longer going to be viable. The institutions are changing, although the functions will continue. In that sense, we're going to see some big changes. I think that's true. It's possible that, however, it will, as with Enronitis, continue to be self-regulation and competitive. It's also possible, however, it will not, and we'll see a new form of running capitalism, which may be relatively authoritarian rather than progressive if we're not careful.
You know, to the extent that you see neoliberalism as an idea, it's going to be delegitimated. But as one of Leo's students put it, if you see neoliberalism as freeing restrictions on capital, on corporations, and increasing restrictions on working people, the kind of structures that are in place already are going to continue, in the sense that globalization is going to continue, the competitive pressures on people are going to continue, the restructuring of jobs is going to continue. So in that sense, neoliberalism will continue, although, as Leo says, it can take different institutional forms.
Let's step back a bit. You've talked about this a little bit already, with especially the relation of finance, but let's step back to the 70s and talk about why neoliberalism came to be. I think there's some people who almost treat it as if somehow the world woke up in a bad mood one day and decided to take this plunge into deregulation and all the other things that have become very familiar to us. But what was it in the 70s that led to this policy of what we now call neoliberalism?
Well, it had both to do with what was happening in financial markets and what was happening inside states, or between states. As I said, what was happening in financial markets was that they indeed were beginning to boom along with the post-war boom. Capital flows between countries, new kinds of financial instruments, the securitization of banking, the development of the euro market, which was a completely unregulated international trade in dollars, in which American financial capital was very heavily involved and increasingly involved. All of that was part of the mix. Now, on the other hand, the American state, which had taken responsibility for getting capitalism going again and globalizing from 1945 on, no other state was capable of it or had an capacity to do it. The American state had established its dollar as the only world currency equivalent to gold. Everything was traded through the American dollar, ultimately. And that came under pressure as a result of the revival of other states, competition to American trade, and as a result of capital flows, especially American multinational corporations and banks, taking money from the United States and investing it around the world and remaking the world in the process. And that meant there were a lot of pressures coming to the United States from around the world, because they were afraid by the 1960s that all of their holdings of dollars would be devalued by inflation. All the more afraid insofar as American workers were succeeding with high wage demands and resisting productivity increases, insofar as the Great Society programs in response to the American civil rights movement and black power struggles were coming into place. And those did produce inflationary pressures, and governments were begging the Americans to cut back on those public expenditures. Rather than do that, the Nixon administration pulled out of the Bretton Woods fixed exchange rate agreement. You couldn't convert American dollars to gold. That still left the world dependent on American dollars as the global currency. But it meant that in order for people to hold dollars, they now had to completely depend on the United States not running inflationary policies if their currency wasn't going to be devalued. And the United States, during the course of the 70s, stumbled around in this, but by the end of the 70s, both because of the enormous growth of finance, which took the lead in pressuring for a crackdown on trade unionism and on public expenditure, and from other countries demanding that the United States play its imperial role responsibly, those two things together produced, not Milton Friedman, those two things together produced what was known as the Volcker Shock, which was an American steadfast commitment to an anti-inflationary policy. Volcker was a pragmatic civil servant and bureaucrat, not particularly Friedmanite, much less an Ayn Rander like Greenspan. It was a pragmatic decision, one that was related to both the imperial responsibilities and the balance of forces inside the United States. And as part of that, public expenditure was beaten back and trade unions were defeated amidst the massive restructuring of industry that 18% interest rates produced. And it inaugurated, that was the founding moment of neoliberalism.
And on its own terms, I would have to call it a success. Would you agree?
I would say it was, in their terms, in financial capital's terms, a tremendous success in terms of reconstituting the American empire. and tying most of the world states to it, it was a great success.
On the other hand, the part of what's going on here is that the financial markets play this crucial role in as part of the solution to the crisis of the 70s in terms of the pressure on labor and restructuring. But this solution of beating down inflation in goods through financial markets ends up with the financial asset bubble over a very long period of time to be the crisis of today. So it was successful in the sense that there was this era of 25 years, longer than the golden age, in which the American economy was very dynamic.
Now, it's often presented as a triumph of finance, but Sam, that's the voice of Sam Gidnon, who we're listening to, along with Leo Panitch, I should say. But Sam, you also spent a lot of time in and around the auto industry, which is about as basic industry gets. Did auto CEOs have any problem with the Volcker agenda that Leo was describing?
No, the auto executives, Leo and I interviewed the head of General Motors, and we asked him that question. Weren't you worried about this because this was going to affect your consumers in terms of the high interest rates, and it was going to affect your own costs? And the response was it was absolutely necessary, that the Keynesianism was over, that they had to deal with the issue of inflation and the strength of the working class, and that this was absolutely necessary, even if it was going to mean pain for the auto industry in the early 80s. And it meant a lot of pain. Employment through the early 80s was virtually cut in half.
And when they talk about inflation, they don't just mean rising prices, do they? I mean, there's a real class political component to when they're talking about inflation, isn't there?
Yeah, no, this was completely about the class struggle inside the plants over both wages, but also in terms of the ability to squeeze workers to get more out of them. It was that limit on how much productivity they could get just by squeezing workers and the pressure from workers to maintain their wages and increase them that leads the corporations to try to offset that and protect their profits by increasing prices. And so you get inflation. So when they're talking about inflation, they really are talking about beating back labor both in terms of its strength in the workplace and its social programs and wages.
But, you know, I think we should pick up on Sam's excellent point that the contradiction of all of this was three decades of asset inflation rather than price inflation. That is important, I think, to help us understand the deep crisis that American capitalism and certainly financial capitalism and with it world capitalism is at the moment facing.
How do you explain that asset bubble?
Well, you know, it seems to have been the product of the fact that the effect of, you know, demonstrating that the dollar was as good as gold, that treasury bills were even better than gold because they paid some interest and they were as safe as it, had the effect of pulling vast amounts of capital into the United States. Once the high interest rates broke the back of American labor and of public expenditure, you got a period of very, very low interest rates in relative terms. And people were coming into the United States despite that. And moreover, with those low interest rates, you could do financial institutions, especially investment banks, could do an enormous amount of leveraging. And you got an explosion in the effective money supply. Ironically, given it was the monetarists who thought they were inaugurating neoliberalism. And a lot of that went into a spinning of financial assets, a leveraging of financial assets or of real estate. Some of those had a real world function. Some of those were involved very importantly in the kinds of mergers and acquisitions activity, in the kind of venture capital that restructured American industry. And although it brought down, if you like, the auto and steel industries, it created and supported the dynamic development of the information revolution, the biomedical revolution that we are still living through in terms of biotech, genetic technology, and so on. And that reestablished the American leadership in many senses in the leading edges of production and capital accumulation. But a great deal of it was indeed about facilitating, as they say, intermediating the enormous risks that being involved in global production, global capitalism, global trade entails. So a lot of instruments were created to hedge risk in terms of floating interest rates, floating exchange rates, uncertain transportation and commodity costs. And people started speculating in the sense of buying what were known as derivative products and assets to hedge their risk, and which involves a great deal of speculators getting involved in that protest, in that process. You know, on top of all of that, workers got drawn into this asset inflation by virtue of being more and more looking to what their pension plans were returning by way of their investments in this process of asset inflation, and cheering the stock market going up on the announcement of layoffs, insofar as this would possibly increase the value of their stocks on the stock market. So this was a mass process. It wasn't only that in which financial capital was involved. It got to be one in which working people were involved insofar as they looked to the assets they had, whether the home they owned or the pension they had, as their means of ensuring that their children did better than themselves, now that their children in this world were not going to do well in terms of any wage or salary income that they were receiving.
This is what George Bush called the ownership society. Sam, I heard you, it sounded like you wanted to add something to that.
Yeah, I was just going to reemphasize where Leo just ended up. That, I mean, the contradictory point about this is that you break the mechanism that workers have for maintaining their consumption through collective bargaining, and then they become dependent on credit. And the massive increase in consumer credit in the United States deepens American financial markets and actually makes them more attractive for all kinds of foreign capital, as you see in terms of the effect of the subprime thing. And part of the contradiction is that on the one hand, you're weakening people's ability to pay back credit, and on the other hand, you're increasing their credit load. And at some point, this is going to break in the weakest link, and that's what we saw in the subprime.
Did the unions, anybody in the unions understand what was going on as this was all evolving since the early 80s?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, for example, on the question of pensions and health care, in the early stages of the developing of these programs, there was a notion that you could bargain these things and maybe extend them to society as a whole. But over time, it simply became a question of improving your own pension and your own health care plan. And the problem with that is that it's a form of privatizing these social benefits. And then as an industry gets into trouble, you're completely vulnerable. There's no way that you can save your pensions and health care. And then the first instinct there then is to ask, well, how do we keep the corporation strong? Rather than, and which fragments you from the rest of the working class, and there's absolutely no solution in that. And I think the unions completely missed that whole issue.
That said, I think that financial capital and its partners in the state, the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, and indeed all of the other treasuries and central banks around the world that they coordinate, I think did become rather blasé about their ability to intervene in ways that would stop any particular spread of a given financial crisis, because there was inevitable. You get this kind of asset inflation, you do get the bursting of bubbles, and you get the state intervening to drop buckets of liquidity on the financial system in particular areas wherever that happened, which is precisely what they did. With the savings and loan, with the stock market crashes in 87, and all the way through. And what finally happened in the inflation that occurred of housing price assets, which has been going on a steady wave for the 25 years, but really accelerated in the last 10 and even more in the last 5 or 6, was that they kind of ran up against the Achilles heel of trying to integrate a working class which was limited in terms of its incomes, and especially the Achilles heel of trying to integrate, this has always been the American problem, the black working class into this. And the roots of this go all the way back, ironically, to those progressives, I'm sure you and I and Sam were in favor of this in the late 70s, who, when the Great Society programs were being cut back, just at the time when you needed this massive public expenditure to deal with the crisis in American cities in the 1970s, what people pushed for was the requirement on banks that they should lend to poor people, especially to African-American communities, to small businesses in those communities, but above all, provide mortgages to poor families. And the irony of that was all the banks were opposed to this, of course. There's only one banker, a Chicago small banker, who spoke in favor of it at the hearings. They were uniformly opposed to it. And what the compromise that was struck with them was that the government-sponsored enterprises in the mortgage field, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, would begin to create a market in derivatives, in asset-backed securities, whereby they would sell packages of these mortgages that the banks would give away. They'd take them off them and would sell them into a secondary market. And you got the beginning then. It wasn't big at that time, and it didn't really become big until Clinton started pushing this again as he embraced neoliberalism but was, after all, the black president, pushed it even further. And then it really took off under Bush, who let every shyster in the world get into this game and vastly reduced the capital requirements of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And you know, it has blown up in their faces. Of course, it's blown up even worse in the faces of the people who should have had public housing and instead were driven into buying, you know, houses in rundown areas of Cleveland or Boston, et cetera, that they were going to have to pay an arm and a leg for eventually through interest rates that would be raised after a year or two.
We're listening to an interview recorded earlier this week with Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin, the Toronto-based political economists. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, the program behind the news. Time for a musical break. Reaching back to 1974 for that one, Burning Airlines, from Brian Eno's album Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy, named after the unbearable Mao-era Chinese opera, one of the few pieces of art that passed muster during the Cultural Revolution. Okay, back to Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin. You said something that really we should really underscore, because when you said Clinton, or even the late end of the 70s, this whole deregulation of finance, which a lot of Democrats and liberals are now blaming on the Republicans, was really a bipartisan
affair. Absolutely. There's absolutely no doubt about it. The Volcker shock was introduced in the run-up to the presidential election of 1980, just as, you know, we now are seeing all of this in the run-up to a presidential election. He was appointed by Carter. This was introduced before Reagan became president. And as I say, Volcker wasn't a particularly partisan figure and isn't one. He's a supporter of Obama right now. And Clinton in particular, you know, having turned on Bush the elder and said it's the economy, stupid, and sounded as though he was a, you know, welfare state Keynesian, very quickly embraced neoliberalism, although he complained that he was in the pocket of some 28-year-old bond trader when he did so.
Using colorful language we can't use on the radio.
That's right. And then, in order to, you know, meet his commitments to his constituency, began to push their integration into financial markets. And it is one of the great contradictions of the center-left, that it tries to make capitalism work for poor people. And they're constantly buying into that illusion.
I was speaking with the voice of Leo Panitch, and also on the line, Sam Gindin, as a frequent collaborator. Now, we've been speaking mostly about the United States, but this has all been really an international affair. Canada, Europe, Japan, they've all played along too, haven't they?
Absolutely. I mean, when you were talking earlier about the confidence of the American state in handling this, part of that confidence came from the fact that the U.S. was attracting capital from all over the world, both from central banks and also from private investors, because it was seen as the safe haven, because of the U.S. dollar, because of the U.S. strength in terms of controlling its own working class and its the international reach of the U.S. So they've all been part of that. And part of what's unwinding right now and part of the uncertainty that's going on right now is the fear that things are now going to start unwinding a lot faster in the rest of the world, even if things start settling down in the U.S. at all.
Things are still pretty placid in Canada, though, aren't they?
Canada's had a different financial system. It's been much more concentrated. But Canada can't help but be affected by what happens in the U.S. It's simply too integrated. And also Canada never had the extent to which Canada also had a housing bubble. It also had rising housing prices, which leaves it vulnerable. But it never had the subprime response, partly because it didn't have the black population and the question of legitimacy there.
Yeah, and partly because we did have a stronger welfare state. The balance of forces was somewhat less asymmetric in Canada in the post-war period than it was in the United States. And therefore, the kind of public mortgage housing corporation we had has been less pulled into market shenanigans, but primarily because our banking system is extremely concentrated, with just a handful of banks through which all of the banking functions take place, insurance, investment banking, etc. The financial fraction of the capitalist class in Canada has always been predominant, going back to our merchant history and the takeover of Canadian industry by American industrial capital so early on. So they are a much more conglomerated set of institutions, and that's where the United States is heading now. It's already was heading that direction before, but the outcome of this crisis is even more going to be the concentration and centralization of financial capital. And ironically, it's going to mean, as in the Canadian case, that the investment banking function is going to be able to have as its backstop the common deposit of the commercial banks. The New Deal tried to stop that by separating commercial banking and investment banking. But all of the investment banks are now being folded into, I mean, half of them already were, but the big ones, but now all of them are being folded into commercial banking, and they're explicitly saying that that will give some of the confidence that's needed because they know they'll be able to draw on the greater safety or the greater liquidity that's provided by having bank deposits.
Assuming we don't have any bank runs.
Good point, I must say, Doug. I think that's entirely true, and I think the thing is very, very iffy and shaky, and there have been a lot of bank runs already, so as a short-term solution, that's not a solution. It's the long-run trend, I think.
And I want to switch the topic now to the United States' role in the world. A lot of people are calling this the end of the American empire or the end of American predominance. And, of course, you two have written a lot on this global structure of the American-dominated global structure. Let's first talk about the nature of that structure. This has not been an imperial structure in which subordinate powers were deeply unhappy with their role. They were pretty comfortable and happy in their subordinates' role, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. The American empire was built on helping the European and Japanese economies in the post-war period to revive. That wasn't altruism. The Americans understood at that time that American capitalism, as they often put it, would not be able to survive unless there was a vast open global space for them and a relatively large number of wealthy countries with which they could trade, to which they could sell their goods, not only extract surplus and resources from. And in that sense, they were promoters of the common market. They were promoters of the Japanese enormous exports to the United States. And that was, in capitalist terms, a virtuous circle. So amongst those advanced capitalist countries, which is, has been the core of American empire, the strongest linkages are with the richest, advanced and most advanced capitalist countries. Not as used to be the case in the old imperialism with the colonial and poorer countries of the South. They've done very well out of this, and are fully integrated in, and the governing of this global capitalism has taken place in a cooperative and coordinated way amongst those states, with the American state being primus inter pares, of course. And when those other capitalist states have been unhappy with the United States, it's been when they have felt that their voices weren't being heard as subordinate contributors to that coordination. But, you know, a lot of them feel that, you know, American domestic politics often gets in the way of acting responsibly with its populism and the close linkages of Congress to so many particular interests. There's also the European noblesse oblige view that the Americans are very dynamic but a bunch of cowboys. And in the crisis of the 70s and in the crisis as well today, there is resentment that the Bush administration has not been playing its global role responsibly enough. That said, they are utterly dependent on what the American state does, and it's been never more apparent than this week when Congress didn't come through with its bailout. And despite the fact the German finance minister was going on about the end of American financial superpowerdom, in the very same breath, he said that they were utterly dependent on the American state to get them out of the, pardon the expression. Chancellor Merkel said the same thing virtually the next day. The Russian finance minister said this week it is the responsibility of the United States to other countries to pass this. And Jean-Claude Trichet, the European Central Bank president, said the United States has to pass this bill, not only for the sake of the United States, but for the sake of global finance. So you see how utterly dependent the world is on the American state as the imperial state of global capitalism, the state most responsible for the making and the reproduction of global capitalism.
And, of course, they hold a few trillion of our securities, too, so they want to keep those stable.
Yes, of course.
I think Leo's last point is absolutely crucial for people to understand, because in the 70s, like today, you get these complaints from Europe. And what they're really asking for is for the U.S. to play its imperial role better. All that frustration is about them feeling often that they're impotent in terms of affecting that role. But the question is, the U.S. is going to retain that imperial role. It's just a question of them playing it better. That's what the issue is about.
I think what a lot of people misunderstand, we just had a interaction with a very smart economist with the Canadian Labour Congress over this just this morning, is, you know, they think that hegemony only holds when things are going good. And when things are going bad, then it means that hegemony is unwinding. But that's not the case. On the contrary, what we see in terms of the strength of American hegemony, even when capitalism is in crisis, is the extent to which the rest of the world is dependent on what the United States does for them not to be drawn deeper into the muck. And that's also, you know, been the case with, as we've learned, with the American working class through the era of neoliberalism. And people thought that, you know, if you weren't giving them the goodies in the form of the kinds of wage increases and social benefits that the Great Society provided or the 60s provided, then it was all over. No, on the contrary, what you saw was the strength of the American ruling class, the strength of the American state, precisely through its ability to integrate working people, even the middle classes, into this, you know, financially driven neoliberal era, even as it was screwing these people.
What do you think of the prospects are for a Democratic administration to renew and revise some of these structures that are looking a little worn now?
Well, you know, I'm always naive about American presidential candidates. I don't know why. I always have some sort of a weakness. And I think that whether it's Carter or Clinton or Obama, that, you know, after the election comes, they will do the kind of thing that FDR did. I know very well that FDR did what he did because of enormous class pressures and movements from below and because of the depths of the crisis as well. But I must say, although you know, I had that hope briefly around Obama and his audacity of hope, that was impressive, and of course having a black candidate is symbolically enormously significant. Watching him through this last month, not only in the debate but more generally, as someone in the New York Times said, he looks like someone who is angling to take over the family business. And that's tremendously sad. Now, I would hope that that is just about the normal Democratic electioneering. And that, you know, he, even as a, you know, relatively pragmatic politician, how can you not? You can't be anything other and become a candidate of one of those parties, especially the Democratic Party. But I, you know, I would still hope that if there would be some pressure from below, if we would indeed begin to see maybe people even occupying the banks or massive demonstrations to insist, you know, on the kind of thing that Bernie Sanders called for in opposing the legislation on the bailout, that is, that there should be a massive surtax, and I would even say a wealth tax, on income earners over $1 million. Saunders claims that would raise $300 billion that would go halfway towards the bailout. But, you know, massive demonstrations beyond that in favor of the kind of infrastructure spending, public housing spending, and so on, that is so badly, badly needed. It's, I'd like to think it's not impossible that an Obama administration could do some of the things FDR did.
I think that, I mean, one of the things that helps is the extent to which the right has been delegitimated in terms of attacking using government money and emphasizing free markets. Some things are going to happen. There's going to be some labor legislation.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that, though, is that, you know, if that's positive, it could should help. But it gets back to what Leo's saying. The issue is so much deeper in terms of the need to transform unions. If they're able to take advantage of this, it isn't just a question of the legislation. The public infrastructure, it's needed even in terms of the question of American competitiveness. It can't be competitive in terms of, so there's some sympathy for that. Although obviously the point would be to take it so much further. The healthcare thing you would think would be absolutely on the agenda, especially when you see people having to choose between their homes and their healthcare, given what's going on.
Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left, so let's, as we usually do with the last couple of minutes, get a little dreamy. With this rupture in the normal political and financial arrangements, what are the possibilities for some sort of more democratic restructuring of the financial system? Just give us some principles of the kinds of things that we could start thinking about. If we're going to spend some public money, what could the public get in return?
Well, you know, I have to say, I think one really needs to be very, very ambitious in this respect. The system will take care of itself in terms of producing some more prudential regulations. And I would hate to get into the position of saying that, you know, they really ought to have their salaries capped at, as some people have, even on the left, in the United States have said, you know, at $2 million rather than $20 million. Because that's obscene in itself. So, you know, I think what, you know, really people ought to be pushing for, is a full democratization of the financial system. Now that's not going to happen quickly, but I think that's the kind of goal that people have to have in mind, that finance ought to be treated as a public utility. And that includes the banking system, but I think it also ought to include insurance companies and pension funds. And it's arguable even that hedge funds ought to be illegal. It ought to be a public utility. Some people on the left have said that it should be one, a public utility that ought to be run by its employees, but, you know, given narrow and particular interests of people in any particular sector, that's probably not the best of ideas. We need to try to invent in ways that have never been done because of the size and complexity and, you know, functionality of the financial system. Some of what it does is absolutely crucial in terms of global trade and so on. We would be inventing the wheel. I think that's very important to say. It's an old, old standard of socialists, and not only socialists, nationalists as well of a progressive type, to talk about nationalizing the banks. And that's because it's been understood that if you're going to have anything that is really about a democracy in which people decide what's going on with their lives, they ought to be decided about how the surplus gets distributed, what it gets allocated to, how it determines what's produced, where it's produced, when it's produced, and so on. That's an old story, but figuring out how to do it, it is an enormous challenge. But there's no point pretending that we can sit back and write a book, you know, in which you draw up the blueprint of how this might work, insofar as there aren't the political forces there to make it a reality and to put their own, you know, interests and creativity into that planning. So I'm reluctant, and I know Sam is as well, to try to draw blueprints for this, but it seems to me that, you know, the scale of this crisis, the volatility of and power of financial capital over the last 30, 40, 50 years, again, should really, really put that on the agenda.
Yeah, and just to reinforce what Leo said, waiting for things to collapse doesn't work. We really have to be sober about what we're up against and what kind of organizing it really means. I mean, you talk about, Leo's not just talking about the nationalization of the banks, but their democratization. Banks have been nationalized. The question is, what do you use that nationalization for? And it means you actually have to talk about, is this going to be used to democratize the economy, for example, which raises a million other difficult questions. And it means that you're in a global context, so you have to talk about capital controls. You know, the trick is not to be so intimidated that we think that nothing can be done, but to be absolutely sober about it so we can think about, well, how do we organize to do this? And as Leo said, this really does mean really being creative. There's no answer sitting there on a shelf that we can pull off.
Well, I thought you two would have it for me. Oh, thanks to both of you. And when you get the answer, please let me know. We've been listening to an interview recorded earlier this week with Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin, the Toronto-based political economists who teach at York University. You can find an essay of theirs on these topics on the ZNet website, or as they say in Canadian, ZNet. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, also from Brian Eno, this from his 1973 album, Here Come the Warm Jets. This song is called Babies on Fire. Till next week, bye. Check the sun.